Welcome to Reboot with Dr. Arasi Maran. I'm your host, Dr. Arasi Maran. I'm an interventional cardiologist, but who feels my work lies beyond the cath lab? And here I am with an initiative to bring you evidence-based science and things which I think may be important and I have learned through experience that are important. So I have a very esteemed guest today, Dr. Aseem Desai. He is a Stanford-trained cardiologist and a heart rhythm specialist with more than two decades of experience treating patients with irregular heartbeats. He uses catheter ablation, implantable devices, and robotic systems to treat the abnormal rhythms. He is also an author, published author, I may say, Restart Your Heart, which is a playbook for thriving with atrial fibrillation. And he also has an upcoming book called The Pulse, Harness Your Heartbeat to Relieve Stress, Improve Focus, and Strengthen Relationships. Dr. Desai's work bridges medicine and meaning, exploring how the heart, brain, and gut communicate with each other via the autonomic nervous system, and how this connection shapes our ability to manage stress, sustain focus, and build healthy relationships. His writing and upcoming books are there for anyone who looks fine on the outside, but feels out of sync on the inside. It can be professionals, caregivers, patients, clinicians alike. He basically offers a framework to help restore rhythm in both heart and in life. Without any further delay, Dr. Desai, thank you so much for joining me. And I know we both have crazy schedules. I call myself the glorified plumber of the heart, and you're the glorified electrician of the heart. And here we are syncing our schedules to make this happen. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much too, Arasi. Yeah, you know, when you're doing some house construction, it's hard to get the electrician and the plumber at the same time. So here
true,
we go.
True. Yeah, we go. Trying to all build it back together. So Dr. Desai, let's start with something personal to you. How did you, you know, make this career path to becoming a heart rhythm specialist or an electrophysiologist, so to speak?
Yeah, that's a great question, Arasi. And I think all of us as physicians have our unique stories, you know, what led us. Usually there's a personal component and then there's an intellectual component. So for me, I was 3 years old and I woke up in the neighbor's house. It was like in the middle of the night and I didn't know where I was. And then I learned from the next door neighbor that they had actually carried me in the middle of the night from my family's home to the neighbor's house and learned that my dad had a heart attack. So my mom was actually with him at the hospital. And so none of that really made a whole lot of sense to me. I mean, my memories are sort of scant of it, but I definitely remember like the lights coming on and the shape of someone in the doorway, that type of thing. And so I grew up, my dad was an oncologist, and I grew up seeing a physician become a patient. And I saw how that heart disease really robbed him of enjoying life. He became very anxious. He was worried he was going to have another heart attack and leave his family unattended to. And so as I went through school, I definitely had an interest in biology and physiology. And then I was really struggling with deciding what to do in medicine once I graduated med school. So initially it was down the route of oncology to be like my dad, following his footsteps. And essentially when I hit residency, I decided to do internal medicine because it gave a lot of options. And when I hit residency, it made it very, very clear when I did the CCU rotation that I love this stuff. You know, like people come in, acute MI, you're ballooning open the artery right away, you're resuscitating people from cardiac arrest. I love inotropes and vasopressors and all that kind of stuff. And you can tell I'm an intellectual nerd when it comes to cardiology. And so I found that part interesting. And then, you know, one day I was like just sitting around a medical intern and one of the electrophysiology attendings walked by me because you read EKGs right next to the EP lab office. And he was like, hey, do you want to write a paper with me? And I wrote a paper on IV amiodarone that was in the Annals of Internal Medicine back in 97. And that was like my interest, you know, really started there. But what's interesting is, you know, when I was in med school, my dad died of a cardiac arrest. It was halfway through med school. Oh, thank you. And so I had to leave everything, go to India. We cremated him. Like literally within a week, I was back at medical school and I compartmentalized the whole thing. And so only now in the last couple of years, actually have I been diagnosed with complex PTSD. I mean, one of the things I didn't realize was that as I do cases, and I don't know about you, but there's a very high stress level in what we do. And it seemed to be almost out of proportion for me sometimes, like the anxiety was almost sometimes just a lot. I was fine in the lab, I did a great job, took care of people, but at home I was just, really, really struggling. And so I learned that I was like basically reliving what happened to him because I had no control over his sudden death. And here I was in control of someone else's life and probably worried on some level that that person was not going to make it. And so I think it just illustrates, us as care providers, that we each have these stories that really influence the kind of doctors we are, kind of people we are. So electrophysiology is just fascinating. I mean, we're kind of the nerds of cardiology. We sit in the middle, we sit in the dark and we study these electrical tracings and, but there's so much technology now available in EP, and I'm in particular interested in atrial fibrillation. That's kind of my niche.
Okay. It's so interesting. I did all my research during residency and even in during cardiology in electrophysiology. So my mentor was Dr. Michael Gold, and he is big into intracardiac defibrillators, and I was like looking at the QRS duration and the response to cardiac resynchronization therapy. And when I was a medicine resident, one of our research projects got accepted to Heart Rhythm Society, and here I am as a second year medical student going to HRS. I have never been this overwhelmed by the size of that conference and the magnitude of the conference and the people I was presenting to, but somehow I just had to be in the cath lab 1 month and I just fell in love with interventional cardiology. So, but nevertheless, that's how my path also came into it. And you're absolutely right. I lost my dad when I was 27 years old, and we never, thank you, but we never process it, right? We just back, boom, 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 running, 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 running. And I think maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, I was like, God, why is that sensation so raw in my brain that it feels like he just died yesterday? And why am I so tearful when we talk about it? And I had to, dissect it and process it. It tells you how little time we give ourselves for such major events in our life, and we just keep running this race for no good reason, honestly.
Yeah. No, I think that that's a great story too.
So, let's come back to the podcast. So here we are. We're going to talk about a very common complaint. You hear it all the time. I hear it all the time. Palpitations. And most of the time, oh, I have palpitations. Like, almost every cardiac patient or a non-cardiac patient talks about that. And no one seems to, they don't, patients or people don't seem to know the difference between this is really abnormal versus, oh, this is just, I'm just feeling my heartbeat, et cetera. When is it benign? When is it abnormal? Can you help the audience dissect between the two?
Yeah, those are great questions. So palpitations can describe a whole host of different kinds of qualities of the pulse. So some people feel it as a bounding sensation, a pounding sensation. Some people feel it, like for example, with premature beats, a flip-flop sensation in their chest, almost like they're going down a roller coaster. Some people have a very rapid pulse rate that you would see in a rhythm like supraventricular tachycardia. So the quality of the palpitations matter and the context. And so, if you're exercising and you feel your heart racing afterwards and it's not coming down, that's probably because you are deconditioned physically. You're not having good heart rate recovery. Or say, for example, you just got into an argument with a coworker or a family member and you feel your heart racing and you feel your heart pounding. Well, that's a sympathetic nervous system in action, a stress response that's causing your heart rate to go up. And our bodies, it's all for survival because the cardiac output or the pump function of the heart, is really a function of heart rate and stroke volume. And heart rate going up is one of our key ways that we respond to physical, mental, psychological stress. So with palpitations, it's really about the quality. Is it irregular? Is it regular? Is it fast? That type of thing. Is it bounding? And so the context matters. So if you're just sitting around and you're calm, and then your heart rate shoots up to 180, like a light switch. We use that term a lot, like a light switch. That typically represents a cardiac arrhythmia or an abnormal rhythm, what we call a reentrant arrhythmia. It's almost like a little short circuit. And so this is an interesting thing, Aresti. A lot of young people are misdiagnosed with panic attacks when in reality they have a cardiac arrhythmia, because by the time they get to the emergency room, they've already converted back to a normal rhythm. So it is like taking your car to the mechanic, the electrical system. And I often tell patients, with interventional cardiology, you see that blockage. It's not like a dynamic thing, on a stress test or on an angiogram. It's present. Whereas with the electrical system, it can come and go. So it's all about correlating symptoms to the rhythm. And that's where devices like Apple Watch, for example, where you can even do your own EKG, really do help tease things out. We have people wear rhythm monitors, and one of the most important things about wearing rhythm monitors is for the patient to press the button so we can see with someone's symptoms, what does it correlate with in the rhythm? Because you want to establish causation rather than association, cause effect.
So, you talked about the quality, the context of it, but I think the quantity also matters, right? Because sometimes I'm like, oh yeah, I felt my heartbeat. And I was like, oh, when was that? 6 months ago. And I'm like, has anything happened in the past 6 months? And they'll be like, no. Then I'm like, it's okay. And, for a certain amount, our heart or our bodies are not perfect all the time, right? So when does you say, oh, this is too much, or can you even quantify it like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to think about when the heart's rhythm is off and it drops blood pressure and it drops cardiac output, you have symptoms, shortness of breath, chest pain, dizziness, you feel like you're going to faint. So the red flag warnings are syncope or fainting, like especially abrupt onset where it comes out of nowhere. The presence or absence of structural heart disease, that's a big risk stratifier for us. And so what I mean by that is, does the patient have a history of valvular heart disease, coronary artery disease? Have they had a prior heart attack? Do they have congestive heart failure? That puts a person in a much higher risk category for pathology when they have palpitations. The sort of interesting thing about sudden death from ventricular arrhythmias is that you have no symptoms. You just go down. You just have a cardiac arrest often. Whereas, when you're looking at pulse rate and quantity, as you asked, the typical pulse rate varies. I mean, that's one of the challenges, that it's so individually based. So people ask, well, what should my heart rate be? Well, it depends on your cardiac conditioning. It depends on your hydration. It depends on how much caffeine you're consuming. It depends on your sleep patterns. All of these things influence the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, which really are what regulate your heart rate and rhythm. And so with regards to, you mentioned something really important, which is that patient who mentioned symptoms 6 months ago, but it hasn't reproduced itself. And that's a key thing we look for: patterns, reproducibility. It's sort of science 101. You don't want to go just based on a one-off set of episodes. Although, if it is a red flag, the red flag in electrophysiology is fainting with trauma. And that goes for slow heart rates, bradyarrhythmias too, drop attacks, no warning, you hit your head. Like, that is either a seizure or it's a cardiac arrhythmia until proven otherwise.
I had a patient who would say he was a caregiver. So he would say he would crawl under the bed to pick up something. And then he suddenly wakes up and he's like, what am I doing here? So basically, when he was bending down and doing something, he passed out and he woke up thankfully, automatically, but couldn't remember what happened. And he's like, it's happened so many times. And here's the cut to prove it. And here's the abrasion to prove it. And I was like, we are going to the hospital right now. We are not going to do a test to figure out. We are going to go to the hospital to figure out because, and he drove himself to the clinic. And so this drop attack could happen behind the wheels. And not only could he harm himself, he could totally destroy another family by causing a road traffic accident. So yes, context and the red flags absolutely, absolutely matter. You know, one of your key areas of expertise is the heart-brain-gut connection. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I will say I learned more from my patients in developing that interest more than anything else. And what I mean by that is if I have a patient with atrial fibrillation, well, we know AFib is triggered not only by the sympathetic nervous system, but by the parasympathetic. You know, everyone says the vagus nerve is great. The vagus nerve helps with heart rate variability, the vagus nerve, et cetera, et cetera. It's great. It's a great nerve. I'm not knocking it. It helps to terminate arrhythmias. But we now know that athletes, especially high endurance athletes who have high vagal tone and low heart rate, are actually at higher risk for atrial fibrillation. It's now considered an independent predictor. And the reason for that is the slower your heart rate, the easier it is for premature beats to trigger atrial fibrillation, almost like matches causing a fire. The fire is AFib. And so one of the things I noticed with my AFib patients, first off, and arrhythmia patients in general, is they would have the episode at home, they'd get to the emergency room, and they convert to sinus rhythm, or we're getting ready to shock them to do a cardioversion and they convert to sinus. And although this isn't necessarily proven, I've definitely seen this reproducible and also talking to my colleagues, I think there is something about the safety of being at a hospital that helps to lower adrenaline levels rather than raise it. You know, if you're suffering, right? That actually helps facilitate the conversion to sinus rhythm. You know, it's again, something not scientifically proven, but it does tap into that autonomic nervous system and the brain-heart connection. We know that broken heart syndrome or Takotsubo cardiomyopathy is a phenomenon where there's acute emotional stress that physically changes the shape of the heart into a spherical structure. Yes, exactly. Yeah, the pot that they used to catch octopi in, right, in Japan. And so we know that essentially anything that boosts your adrenaline level will trigger issues in the heart. And the heart is an emotional and sensation organ. You know, it has 40,000 neurons in it that send information to the brain. There's studies that show that when people witness a violent scene, changes in their heart rate actually and blood pressure precede their central nervous system actually processing it, their cognitive processing of the event. And so that's a really fascinating issue. So you have this bidirectional relationship between the heart and the brain. We know that people who have anxiety, people who have depression, there's associated drops in heart rate variability with that. There's associated increase in cardiovascular mortality. We know that with our bypass patients, right? And so the gut's an interesting one because the gut, you know, there's all this interest now in gut-brain connection. And one of the things, and the gut has 500 million neurons, and it creates most of the immune response that we have. We know that the foods we eat and the byproducts of bad bacteria in our gut directly influence the amygdala, your emotional center of your brain. And so we see this kind of triad. I call them the three brains where, you know, when we talk about feeling something in our gut, a tightness in our gut, a gut sensation, it's you physically feel it there. And the same thing with the heart. And the same thing with the brain. And so, you know, the vagus nerve is what interconnects a lot of these. With AFib, for example, you have the esophagus that sits right behind the left atrium where AFib comes from. We have people who have esophageal issues trigger their AFib and vice versa because of the proximity of the organs and the dual innervation of the vagus nerve. And we have people who eat a large meal and they get bloated and it triggers their AFib. So you see this sort of bidirectional communication, which is really important because I had one gentleman, for example, that was having a bunch of premature ventricular beats. And no matter what medication we did or what have you, we couldn't get him to calm down. He figured on his own it was a gluten allergy. It was a gluten sensitivity. And when he cut it out of his diet, his PVCs got better.
You know, this reminds me of the heart-brain, heart-gut connection, which I see when patients have blockages in the blood vessels of the heart. Most of the time, the right coronary artery, it's somehow, for whatever reason, it's the same vagus nerve. Patients will be burping a lot, you know, after they have a big meal and the blood kind of rushes to the gut. And if they have a blockage, that triggers like angina kind of a thing. And they'll start burping and burning sensation like heartburn. And the only time they actually realize it is when I'm blowing up a balloon in their blood vessel. They're like, oh, I'm getting the heartburn. And I'm like, that's not your heartburn. That's actually your angina. And it's very fascinating that we are all so connected, and the heart knows what the gut is doing, and the gut knows what the heart is doing. We can't escape each other, unfortunately.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Coming on to what I call in my mind is a crisis, which is the onslaught of energy drinks, which is available right now. As an electrophysiologist, what are your thoughts about these high caffeine, high sugar energy drinks, which are so openly available to our children and to the rest of the world, pretty much?
Yeah, it's really problematic. I mean, these are essentially, intravenous adrenaline in oral form. And so we know that chronic elevated adrenaline stresses the emotional system, the mental system, and the physical system. And so with a lot of cardiac arrhythmias, it's often nature and nurture. So if you have a genetic history of cardiac arrhythmias, for example, or you have any kind of heart disease, and then you're consuming a lot of these energy drinks, it's essentially putting a stress on the electrical system of your heart. What's interesting about, caffeine, for example, is it used to be thought that caffeine was a big trigger for AFib. Now it's known that 1 cup a day of caffeine is okay. But when you exceed 400 milligrams a day, that's really where you're talking about an impact on your physical health. So small amounts of caffeine can improve focus. Small amounts of caffeine in many cases, I mean, it can even help with regards to risk of dementia. So there is something about caffeine that is not all bad, but you combine that with preservatives and all the other things that are in these energy drinks. And that's the, one of the challenges too, is like you have athletes that have sudden death, right? From hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, long QT syndrome. And so they may not necessarily know, they have that, and then they're consuming all these energy drinks, and it can be a big problem. The other thing is that, the electrical system, the cardiovascular system, autonomic nervous system, it doesn't like surprises. So that's why aerobic exercise is great, right? Because your heart rate ramps up and it comes down, and you have this interplay between vasodilation, et cetera. And with energy drinks, you're having this abrupt increase in adrenaline, an abrupt drop. It's like a surge. And that's a shock to the system, not just the heart, but overall to the mind and body.
So, a lot of the times the so-called pre-workout drinks are basically super caffeinated. And I find it extremely disturbing to consume a large amount of caffeine and immediately go run or lift heavy weights, etc., where that itself by itself is going to cause attack increase in heart rate because you're exercising. So it's like you are adding a second layer of stressor when you're stressing the heart. And now there's been these increased in the media at least, increased awareness or increased reports of people having sudden cardiac death in the gym where they're working out and etc. What do you think about that correlation? Are we just seeing more of it because of social media, or is there something else happening with all this change in behavior?
No, I think that's a great question. I mean, obviously awareness has increased tremendously for not just cardiac issues, but cancer issues. That awareness happens because of technology. That awareness happens because you're able to spread information much faster. You mentioned something that's really problematic, which is social media, that there's a lot of these social media influencers who have no medical background that are sending these messages out to people, and people are often going to social media or ChatGPT more than they're going to their own physicians. I think that, the awareness, for example, of like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, long QT, these various conditions that cause sudden death in athletes, the part of the increased awareness for that is like echo screening, on athletes, for example, to look for some of these issues. So I think that we are seeing some of what is perceived as an increased amount, mainly because we're picking this stuff up more, right? I think though that with how how many toxins in it are we encounter every day, whether they're digital toxins or whether they're environmental toxins or food-based toxins. All of those things definitely are contributing to overall risk. You think of like risk of sudden death or arrhythmias, you think of like a threshold, and you hit that threshold, and that's where you get the arrhythmia. Everyone thinks AFib, oh my gosh, I just had AFib. It came out of nowhere. No, it came because of years of obesity, years of sleep apnea, years of diabetes, years of uncontrolled blood pressure, years of drinking alcohol. Those things add up over time, all of those risks. It's no different than atherosclerosis. I mean, the acute MI didn't happen out of nowhere. I mean, it happens in a silent level. And so I think you're right. I think, with caffeine, for example, and we can talk about alcohol too, but with caffeine, it's the trigger, it's the match. I mean, that's really what it is, that if you're already in a dysregulated state, whether it's emotionally, mentally, or physically, the caffeine is just going to lower that threshold to trigger abnormal rhythms, both ventricular and atrial. With regards to alcohol, to pivot for a second, we can come back to caffeine if you'd like. Alcohol is really problematic for the cardiac conduction system. We used to think holiday heart, large amounts of alcohol triggered AFib. Now we know that even moderate consumption of alcohol is associated with independent risk of AFib. There was a large study out of the UK, like 40,000 people, no history of AFib, and moderate amount of alcohol intake was associated with an increased risk. University of California, San Francisco did a study where they did EP study during ablation for AFib, and they infused a micro dose of intravenous ethanol, and they put a catheter in the left atrium, and there was shortening of the effective refractory period, the ERP. That's essentially a measure of how easy it is to induce AFib, to trigger AFib. So, alcohol, multiple levels, it activates the sympathetic nervous system, it causes you to be dehydrated and get electrolyte imbalance, and it has a direct toxic effect, not just on the electrical system, but on the cardiac muscle itself, right? So caffeine and alcohol both are dehydrate you and contribute to electrolyte imbalance, which act as arrhythmia triggers as well.
So that comes to a question which I'm sure you have heard very frequently, and I've heard very frequently. What is the safest amount of alcohol to have?
Well, I am not popular amongst my patients. This is the way I phrase it to them. I'm like, if you don't want another AFib ablation, okay, if you want to avoid another one, we got to treat the risk factors and stop drinking alcohol. I can't tell you how many people who have been free of AFib after an ablation for like years, and they have one drink at someone's wedding, and it puts them into AFib. I kid you not. We see it over and over again. So my advice, I mean, we know alcohol is associated with dementia. I mean, and the thing is that it's so much of it's so much is yeah, exactly. So much of it's mental. I mean, once you, it's the best way to drop a few pounds. I mean, if nothing else, if you're trying to lose weight, get rid of the empty calories, it's alcohol. I think one of the challenges is people are in social circles where everyone is drinking alcohol, and there's a pressure. Not necessarily, mean kind of pressure, but, people are like, oh, I have a glass of wine with me, and it relaxes you. This is where I think it's really important to pay attention to your body, like intuitive eating. Just do an experiment. Don't get down on yourself for drinking alcohol. The most important thing with habit change is like not to beat yourself up about it. It's to develop awareness. So next time you have that glass of wine, notice how do you feel when you first drink the glass? How do you feel when you're done with it? And then track your sleep on your wearable if you have one. You'll start to notice these cause effect associations, and you'll begin to say, you know what? Like, I don't feel good. And so for me, I loved wine, and for years I enjoyed the occasional glass of wine. Then I realized, my gosh, it was really impacting my sleep. I felt terrible the next day. And I think people when they that's why you have like dry months out of the year, that I think it's worth, there's a great book called The Naked Mind, and it's all about the sort of impact on the brain's physiology and how alcohol creates, an addiction even at a micro level. Like you don't have to have addictive disorder. There's a level of addiction and tolerance that develops, and it is so subtle But you just need to play tricks with your mind. You need to replace that glass of alcohol, even take a wine glass and put seltzer water in it. You know, these little things, and the non-alcoholic wines have gotten a lot better. Non-alcoholic beers are actually quite good. So, you know, it's a challenge, but I tell my patients, don't drink. Yeah, I mean, I you know, but I very importantly, you know, I always caution it by saying, look, there's no judgment here. Like, this is your choice. I am here as your advisor. And I tell them my own story. I used to love it. I'm just like you. I used to love it. But then I noticed I didn't feel as well. I noticed that, you know, you're not thinking as clearly. And you don't remember as much because it's impacting your cognitive function, you know?
I think for me, yes, all of the above, but it's a cognitive decline, which kind of, I feel, gets accelerated the more you drink. And I'm not who I am when I was in my 20s and 30s. And as I'm entering my 50s, I'm like, my brain is the most valuable. My cognition is the most valuable tool I have. And I'm not going to do anything to risk that. And I think it's always, why do you want to do this? Like, if your why is not important enough, then you're not going to stick to any habit, right? When I entered my 40s, the fear of diabetes came into me, and that was my why. So that led to weight loss, getting into shape, exercising, giving up my favorite addiction, chocolates, things like that. So now, as I'm entering into my 50s, cognition, I do not want to have mild cognitive impairment, and that's my why. So I think figuring out why do you have to change is, and making sure that is important enough and that's big enough, and that can help you change your behavior.
I think that's a great point because, you know, as humans, like we sort of have a binary approach to everything in life, which is pleasure versus pain, reward versus threat, you know, safety versus threat. And so I think if you figure out that your why, and that why can either be a positive or a negative, like I don't want to get this, or I want to get that, I want to feel, have more vitality, I want to live longer and healthier. You know, we talk about health span rather than lifespan now. So you can have those positive things, or it could be the negative things that you want to avoid. And, you know, you ask most people, they would rather die than have a stroke or have dementia, because our brains are really how we identify ourselves and how other people identify us. And so I think you're right. I mean, for me, it's actually a very similar reasons. I didn't want it to impact my cognition, you know, especially in what we do. I mean, we need to be very, very sharp.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we are in a state, or we are in an era where we could potentially increase our health spans if we change our behavior. And that's what, yeah, I think all of us are trying to do with your work, and what I'm trying to do with this podcast is, let's be healthy. Instead of, you know, when I see 40-year-olds who are sick and having heart failure and end-stage renal disease and rhythm disorders, I'm like, and they all want to live long. And I'm like, oh, your quality of life is going to not be the same. You may have a decent quantity because modern medicine can, yeah, increase the quantity, but the quality is going to be so absolutely miserable. And it's a very difficult conversation to have with young patients.
It is. And I think one of the challenges is that there's so much stuff that happens in our body at this, you know, sort of microscopic level that we can't see. If people actually saw like their brain tissue after a drink of alcohol and what was happening, you know, that'd be a whole different story. Like with functional MRI scans, now we have a much better appreciation of different mood states. We have a much better appreciation of what's happening in the brain with different interventions, you know, but you talk about any habit change and things like alcohol, like sugar, you know, you also think about access. So, you know, if you want to reduce your intake of these things, like get rid of all the alcohol in your house, you know, or at least start small, you know, but limiting your access to it, that's a simple thing to do. And you got to pick just one small thing at a time, but, you know, micro changes is really important with habit formation. But I would say that the access piece, and then your circle, your social circle, That's one of the really problematic aspects of things is that, and it doesn't mean you have to get a whole new set of friends, but it means, maybe you're the person who proposes to people, hey, you know what, let's not go to the bar tonight. Let's do something alternative. Let's go to Dave and Buster's and or let's go to a batting cage and
A
like, you know,
bowling alley or
yeah,
pickleball, whatever.
exactly. Yeah.
I want to kind of now move into a very, I mean, it's a very popular topic, actually, wearables. I wear one. I'm sure you have your favorite wearable technology, whether it's Apple Watches, Fitbit, Whoop, Oura Ring, Garmin. I mean, I kind of feel like almost everybody is attached to a wearable in some form. Even otherwise, they track their steps on their cell phones, right? This has led to maybe a couple of problems. They are obsessing over what's happening with their heart rates. And they're like, oh my God, my heart rate was in the 130s and I was just sleeping at that time, or I was just watching TV at that time. Something is wrong. And it's kind of led to a little bit of anxiety. And it's also led to, actual, oh, I was feeling dizzy, like the red flags, correlation with the red flags and some association, How do we, what is the message you want to tell this world where everyone is wearing a wearable? How do they manage it efficiently and how do they use the data sensibly?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit like social media consumption. Maybe pick one day out of the week where you're reviewing the data. Maybe don't necessarily like look at it every day because that alone is anxiety provoking. And then, if you even feel the hint of palpitations, then you're going to be thinking, you look at the numbers, you're going to be thinking, oh my gosh, I'm having these spikes in the middle of the night. This is probably AFib. And sometimes it is. I mean, I'm not saying it isn't. We have seen these watches save people. We have seen these watches, pick up, someone got an Apple Watch for Christmas. And as soon as he did the EKG recording, he was an AFib. So, I mean, they definitely do help, but it's all about context. Again, it gets back to, okay, someone brings in these reports and they're like, hey, I see my pulse doing all sorts of things. Well, then you start probing and you're like, okay, well, tell me what's going on in your diet. Tell me what's going on with your hydration, your caffeine, your stress level, your sleep patterns, because oftentimes it comes down to a lifestyle piece that's driving, the pulse is a measure of what's happening inside. It's a metric. It's our first metric. That's why, we many of us in medicine know this book, The House of God, where one of the rules of the House of God is when you arrive at a code, take your own pulse first. The pulse is a measure, it's a metric of the state of what's happening in your body. And so don't look at numbers, look at trends. That's a case for heart rate variability, for example. The heart rate variability, people often ask, well, what's
You have to explain heart rate variability.
Yeah.
I have tried to explain it to my own
I
husband, and
will.
he's like, I don't understand what. So please explain what is heart rate variability.
Absolutely. So heart rate variability, it's the beat to beat variation in heart rate. And so when I say beat to mean, I literally mean each heartbeat. So 60 beats a minute is not a metronome in music of 60 beats a minute where there's equal time intervals between notes. It's 60 beats a minute with, and I'm talking about milliseconds, so not seconds, but a thousandth of a second. So like 10 milliseconds, that's where you see that MS on heart rate variability on your wearable. It's literally like such a small up and down. And so what it represents is the balance of your autonomic nervous system. In particular, it's really influenced by the parasympathetic nervous system through the vagus nerve, more so than the sympathetic nervous system. So when you see a drop in heart rate variability, when you see a small heart, a low heart rate variability, that usually corresponds to a faster heart rate because the faster your heart rate is, the less variability there is. The slower your heart rate, the more variability there is. The slower your heart rate, the more active your parasympathetic nervous system is. The faster your heart rate, the less active your parasympathetic nervous system is, and the more active your sympathetic nervous system is. So HRV is one of those things that it's great, right? Because it's a numerical value and it's something that can be tracked. But you have to think about in the context of like, say, for example, you're looking at HRV and you're looking at like your sleep score. and say you don't feel good. So one thing that's really helpful is you could look at your HRV in the morning and try to tie it to how you feel that day. So then if you notice, okay, well, there's days that my HRV is higher and I feel better. Don't focus on like Googling what's a good HRV. Focus on the trends that you're seeing yourself, because it's very individually based. You know, that's one of the challenges with wearables. The other thing is all the algorithms are different between these different companies. And so heart rate variability was really born out of Holter monitors and heart rhythm monitors and physiology labs, where we had much more accurate ability to measure these slight variations in heart rate. So, you know, it's also borrowed out of the sports literature. So HRV traditionally was more of a measure of physical conditioning, physical resilience. There is data now on how your emotional state and your mental state actually impact heart rate variability. There's been several studies on various conditions such as depression, anxiety, even bipolar disorder, various psychiatric conditions, and how you have lower HRV with that. So less variation typically is a faster heart rate, usually means your parasympathetic is withdrawn and your sympathetic is overactive. In electrophysiology, we have very interesting information on how we incorporate HRV. So our implantable devices, our heart failure devices, the cardiac resynchronization devices, our implantable defibrillators, even our pacemakers, actually report HRV. And that is at a very accurate level, because you have a lead sitting in the heart. So it's measuring beat to beat at a very accurate level. And so what we've learned is that a drop in the HRV predicts a heart failure hospitalization, because again, you have parasympathetic withdrawal, sympathetic overactivation. And so when you go on a beta blocker for congestive heart failure, you can still interpret HRV, because the HRV is largely impacted by parasympathetic activity, not sympathetic. And the beta blockers impact the adrenergic receptors of the heart, the input that the sympathetic nervous system has. So there is, you can still follow it, but the risk of sudden death and cardiac arrhythmias, a drop in the HRV correlates with that. So we have to just remember where the HRV data came from, because now, like, you know, many of these companies likely found this literature and then now it's a marketing tool. And so we have to just be very careful about. Now, the other interesting thing is atrial fibrillation is a chaotic arrhythmia. You want to talk about heart rate variability. It's all over the map. So I have a patient who noticed his HRV went up right before he had an AFib episode, because when he went into atrial fibrillation, the amount of variation between heartbeats increased significantly. So that's something to keep in mind, is that high HRV is not always necessarily, but it also illustrates, you got to connect the metric with the symptom, with the context. So he knew he was just you know what I'm saying? Because that's really where I think, you know, the wearables, the wearables are not a judgment, they're data, and you have to incorporate it and you have to look at patterns. But I would definitely, I have had people who get so obsessed and it causes anxiety. I have people just, you know, just put it in your drawer. Like, don't, because in the end, you're going to know if something bad's happening. If you're really in tune with your body, like, even if you're in denial, you know, deep down something bad is happening. And so your intuition, your, and again, this gets back to interoception, which is your sensation, your ability to sense body signals, like issues in your gut or your heart, your neuroception, which is sensing your sort of safety and threat response. These components of our nervous system, they're in many ways much more relevant indicators. And that's where the wearables can potentially help, because if you're feeling off in any which way, and that's what my upcoming book is really about, is, you know, using your pulse and using interoception and correlating it with some of this data to help identify, are you heading towards burnout? Are you heading towards conflict in your relationships? Are you more distracted because of digital being digitally toxic and it's impacting your focus? So that's really, I see the wearable. You know what I think of is, I think of the SOAP note that we use in medicine. And that's kind of where this acronym from my book, Pulse, P-U-L-S-E, comes from, is Subjective is the symptoms that we hear from a patient, the story. Objective is their vital signs, their physical exam, the laboratory data, the diagnostic testing. Assessment is us putting the subjective and objective together, and what are the different possibilities? It's a differential diagnosis. And then you come up with a treatment plan. But after the plan, you also do a reassessment and you look for patterns, putting the person on a GLP agent, you know, what impact did it have on their weight? So with this acronym, I like to think of, again, take your own pulse first. So if someone is stressed, you know, taking a deep breath is one of the best ways to manage it. But if you just count your pulse for 60 seconds, that's going to get you out of your head because you're focused on a number now. You're getting out of your head. But, you know, the P is perceive, like, perceive, is something off in your thoughts, in your mood, in your physical sensations? You was trying to uncover what was the first thing that was off, because if it was a physical symptom that then triggered anxiety versus if it's anxiety triggering a physical symptom, that is very helpful. And then L is like really looking deeper, you know, is there something in your lifestyle? Are you consuming too much caffeine or energy drinks? Are you reliving old trauma? Like you said, you know, with your dad, and I said with my dad, you know, are we reliving old trauma? That's a big one. Trauma is like very, very, very common. And then, you know, S is really synchronizing these three brains you have, your mind, your heart, and your gut, and figuring out lifestyle ways, breath work, meditation, mindfulness, getting out into nature, forest bathing, all of these things to help resynchronize. And E is really evaluating over time, you know, tracking these patterns.
Fantastic. That's awesome. So, you know, I want to kind of, we're coming close to time. So before we wrap up, what is the one thing you wish every person listening today would understand about their heart, something that could change how they live, breathe, or handle stress? What would that one advice you would give them?
Your heart has an intelligence, and get in tune with listening to it. And that starts with learning to take your pulse in your wrist or your carotid artery and getting very comfortable with understanding the nuances between quality and quantity. What does it feel like versus what the number is, and correlating it to what you're doing? So take your own pulse first. If your kid's having a meltdown like mine does uncommonly, take your pulse. These things will give you a moment of pause. And just remember that your body's intuition, your body really knows a lot more oftentimes than our mind does. Our mind and our perception in our head tends to be actually quite inaccurate, whereas our body is a much better sensory organ to assess true reality.
Fantastic. That's very helpful in so many different levels. Where can people learn more about your work, and when can we expect Pulse to be available?
Well, the work that I do, I have a Substack called Pulse, Strategies to Help Live in Rhythm, Science, Story, and Strategies to Help Live in Rhythm, where I do patient vignettes. And I also like to bring in ancient wisdom, Stoic philosophy, things like that, Vedanta philosophy. And so I have the Substack. I'm on social media at all the major channels. My website, drasimdesai.com, drasimdesai.com. I have a whole host of resources for people, publications. I'm on Psychology Today. I'm one of the writers for Psychology Today. So I have a column called Mindful Beat. And then the Pulse book, we're looking at probably in the next 8 to 12 months. So we're in the process of sort of finalizing, you know, some of the way the book is structured, but it's really meant to be a playbook, You know, there's so many books out there about mindfulness and thought reframing and your breath work, but I'm really looking at the heart, you know, in terms of it being not just, you know, it's not just a physical organ, it's an emotional organ, and using the pulse is the simplest metric you can do. I mean, you literally put your fingers on your wrist and you have it right there. And so I would encourage people to DM me through social media. And I just, you know, I really just want to send people with the message of, you know, this is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And just pick one small thing you want to change in your life, whether that's going to bed an hour earlier, that one thing, focusing on sleep, I would say sleep is probably the biggest thing people should focus on, would be the one parting message.
Fantastic. With October 1st come and gone, I told my social media audience to kind of think of a 90-day reset so that the version of you on January 2nd can look back and be like, oh, I've actually doing much better this January 1st compared to 2025 January 1st, because I took the steps 90 days ago to be a better version. So it's a marathon, and one single step always comes a long way.
I think that's a great point, because, I think that's a good, important message to leave people with, is learn a way to track how you're improving over time, whether that's in a phone or whether that's just writing in a journal, because a lot of times our subjective view is that, oh, I'm not getting any better, I'm not getting anywhere with exercise. Well, guess what? You did 2,000 more steps this week than you did last week. So I think that that's a good point you're making.
Absolutely. So Dr. Desai, thank you so much for being here today. This conversation has been, eye-opening in so many different ways, understanding what really is happening when we feel, from unsettling palpitations to understanding how our habits is changing our energy and the way we think. So thank you so much. For everyone listening, I'll put links to Dr. Desai's book, Restart Your Heart, and his Substack information. And if today's conversation resonated with you, or you know of someone who's struggling with life, struggling with palpitations, relying heavily on energy drinks, overwhelmed by health data, please do share this episode, and they might benefit from hearing it. And thank you all for listening. And Dr. Desai, thank you so much for all the work you do. Until next time, take care of your hearts, literally and figuratively. Goodbye.